This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Newspapers, the airwaves, and the web, they offer us lots of information about eating and our health. But when it comes to putting it into perspective or into practice, well, that, all that information can be a challenge. And so that's one of the reasons we do this monthly program on nutrition. That's our topic this afternoon. We take up the topic on the first Monday of the month. Our guest today is a registered dietitian at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her name is Lisa Burgoon. She teaches in the Food Sciences and Human Nutrition Department in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. She's also the co-author of a textbook on sports nutrition published earlier this year, the title, Practical Applications in Sports Nutrition. Listeners, your questions about diet and nutrition are invited. If you'd like to talk with Lisa Burgoon, give us a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you may call toll-free. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Thanks for coming in. Good to see you again.
Thanks. Nice to see you, too.
And what should we start with this afternoon? Just very briefly, because I think we've got a call coming in already. So anything you want to just mention at the top?
Well, certainly trans fats are on the public agenda and the educational agenda for dietitians. So certainly we can talk about that when we get an opportunity. The big issue coming out of New York City right now is whether or not they're going to ban the use of trans fats in foods that are served in restaurants. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, let's talk with a listener. Caller on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about yogurt cheese. You know, when you drain the yogurt to make yogurt cheese?
Mm-hmm.
What's the calorie count? Is the calorie count of the, say, you drain a quart and you end up with 2 cups. Do you have the full calories of the 4 cups, or do you have half the calories, and are there calories in the whey or whatever the liquid is called?
Wow. You might have actually stumped me on the first question. When I think about it, because I actually was just talking with somebody, actually a secretary at work was telling me I really should do this and I really should make my own yogurt, etc. And I'm thinking that when you drain a lot of that and when you do that process, you're losing some water, and water doesn't have any calories. So, but
right.
You're
it's
also
not,
separating
it's not
out the whey.
Water.
Right, exactly. You're also separating out the whey. So I'm thinking that I would have to find out how much of the actual whey compared to what your original product had. Say you said a quart.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had a quart and you ended up with 2 cups and maybe a third or a half cup of that was whey, you'd have to take those calories out, which are primarily protein. So you could probably use the grams of protein that was in that original quart container, you know, divide out about 1/4 of that, the protein grams. Let's just make it easy. And let's say it was 20 grams, multiply by 4, because that's how many calories is in 20 grams of protein. So subtract out 80 calories from the total. That's, you could do that math once you figure out how much of that is actually separated out.
Well, it says 11 grams of protein in 1 cup, 120 calories, 19 grams carbohydrate.
Okay.
And
how many servings in the container?
Well, that was for one serving. There are 4 servings in the container.
Okay.
That was for 1 cup.
So 44 total grams of protein.
Right.
Okay.
Which would be 44 times 4, 176, something like that. Out of 480.
Right. But what you need to subtract out is the amount of the extra protein types of things that you're separating out. So you'd have to, that's the hard part, is trying to figure out how much of that actually, how much is left versus how much is out. I'm not sure. That would be the way I would do it. But since I can't see it and I don't know how much there is there, I'm not sure that I can tell you that. But keep in mind that if you can figure out how much of that, you know, overall came out, you're going to then multiply the grams of protein, because it's pretty much going to be protein that's left. There might be some carbohydrate, but mostly protein. And then
that's left or that came out?
that the stuff that separated out that you're not gonna consume.
Oh.
The stuff that you lost, I guess, is the best way to describe that. So it's not going to be an easy calculation. I don't know if there's any place that you could find on the web the calorie and protein count of. You might go to some vegetarian types of resource areas. Some vegetarian, if they're not vegan vegetarians, do this a lot, and they might have, this is about how much you can expect nutrient wise.
Maybe Stonyfield's Farms.
Mm-hmm.
On their website.
Exactly. That might be a really good choice.
They have recipes with yogurt cheese.
Yeah. That's a great recommendation, because I'll bet you that they may have that.
Okay,
thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana. Hi.
I wasn't calling about that, but thinking about the yogurt cheese, because I was wondering about the calories, too, I would think that there wouldn't be that many calories in the whey, and that you don't have to be down to the exact number. If you're just talking about using a couple of tablespoons on crackers or something for the yogurt cheese, I wouldn't think there'd be that. If you missed a few calories or had too many calories in there, it wouldn't make that much difference in your overall daily consumption. But what I was calling about was I just got the Alzheimer's Association little newsletter, and it's talking about, it has a headline, Deepening Connections Between Diabetes and Alzheimer's. And it mentions sugar-related toxins may contribute to formation of Alzheimer plaques and tangles, among one of the interesting things that they are looking at, in addition to the fact that it seems that pre-diabetes, even extra weight and pre-diabetes, can be risk factors for developing Alzheimer's. Another reason for us to watch those calories and to lose weight. But I've never heard of sugar-related toxins. That's the first time I bumped into it. Do you have any idea what they're talking about?
Well, yeah, that's a new term to me in terms of the toxin part, but it may be related to, you know, just the regular old breakdown of sugars. There's all kinds of things that happen in the body that are breakdown, you know, products. And so I've never heard them called toxins before, so I'm not sure exactly, you know, what that might mean. Anytime that some of the sugars or even carbohydrates and protein are broken down, you know, they're broken down into these very minute broken down by enzymes, broken down by a lot of different things, and they break down into a variety of different, you know, very monosaccharide types of things, and most of them are usually pretty benign, but I've never heard the term sugar-related toxins either. Did they list anything in particular, like a name of anything? Did it end in OL? Did it?
No, it's just one paragraph. It says sugar-related toxins may contribute to formation of Alzheimer plaques and tangles. Researchers from New York's Mount Sinai School of Medicine found that compared with people with low levels of these toxins, so it's something that they're measuring, those with the highest levels performed significantly worse on 6 different tests and tended to do worse on 4 additional tests. So it's something that is measurable in people's blood,
right.
I would assume in their blood. But it's maybe something that somebody is just realize, and we haven't seen it showing up in other newsletters, etc.
Right. Yeah. And they're doing so much research on Alzheimer's these days that, you know, we used to talk about it just with, you know, vitamin E and prevention of Alzheimer's. And now they're looking at all kinds of things that might be contributing to Alzheimer's disease. So it's not surprising there's some new studies out there.
Well, they were just talking on the radio on WLL just a short time ago about Alzheimer's, and that what we really should be doing, instead of trying to find a cure, is trying to prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
And also trying to help people who already have it. And just one of those other things that we need to take responsibility for in our own lives, get our weight down, get our exercise up, etc.
Right.
And I'm speaking for myself as well. Looking around, I see America's Middle going by as whenever I'm out.
Yes.
So it's one more thing to work on.
Right.
Here. Thanks.
Great.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited for our guest, registered dietitian Lisa Burgoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL and 333-WILL. Back to trans fats, I guess.
Right.
No one waiting at the moment.
Okay.
So is that? It seems to me that this is something that's very achievable, is it not?
Yeah, your goal is to not consume trans fats at all. So, you know, you've got recommendations about how much saturated fat, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated fats, and all of those are, you know, you can have some of those. You want to try and limit, of course, the saturated fats. But pretty much the goal is zero with trans fats. And, yeah, you can accomplish that through primarily watching the food labels. Any foods that are labeled, they can tell you whether or not there's 0 grams of trans fat or not, because that's the new labeling laws of January of 06. And primarily, you want to watch for fried foods and foods that are pre-prepared, like cookies, packaged cookies, crackers. Snack foods are a big culprit, but even in other prepared types of foods. And it's because, and the thing to look for to avoid trans fatty acids is that partially hydrogenated word. So it's a manufactured fat. That's how we pretty much get it. There's a little bit of trans fats out there in regular everyday foods, but not very regular everyday foods and in very minuscule amounts, which primarily in foods that have been altered. The partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, whether it's partially hydrogenated coconut or palm or vegetable or soybean or whatever, it's the hydrogenation that makes it the trans. And so that leads us to how in the world will all of the restaurants in New York City be able to successfully get all the trans fats out of their foods when they get their oils from places outside of the city. They have foods that are semi-prepared and brought in so they can prepare them quickly. I think it'll be a real challenge to do that in a particular area or a particular restaurant. On the other hand, I think it's something that is achievable. Frito-Lay took all of the trans fats out of their snack foods. They just did it, you know, and there aren't trans fats in their foods. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't fats, and that doesn't mean there aren't other fats that we might want to watch out for, but it can be done. You know, so that's something to think about as well. And the trans fats are the ones that primarily raise that bad LDL, the bad cholesterol, which is the LDL cholesterol. That's the reason that we're so concerned about that.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me now with food labeling, like say Frito-Lay, their packaging then screams at you. Well, not screams at you, but it says...
It's pretty clear.
It says zero trans fats. Yeah. So you go, okay, you're coming home with me.
Exactly.
But so it seems to me that manufacturers packaging, their packaging, it's pretty clear now if it's zero. If it's zero, it's going to say zero.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And they will. And manufacturers are really savvy about screaming that on their label. We don't have trans fats anymore, because they want you to buy their product because of that. Now, unfortunately, the consumer sometimes assumes that, oh, maybe they're fat free, you know, and maybe I'll eat more because there's no trans fat. So you have to be a savvy consumer. But sure. And on the back of that label, all foods have to be labeled. All packaged foods have to have a label, and they have to, it has to be truth in labeling as well. So the big manufacturers, you know, they've got this down to a science, and they have the funds to do fancy labeling and to redo their oils that they are using.
Yeah,
it's the smaller ones are a little harder.
Another recent change we've seen in terms of labeling is whole grain. Everything is whole grain. But when you get to the nitty gritty, it's like, well, what does that mean exactly? You know, what is it? It says excellent source, good source.
Right.
It's like, what does that mean? You have to go to the back, you have to go to the small print and see grams.
Right.
Which brings me to this point. What's a reasonable amount of whole grain, you know, in a serving? What is a good or excellent source of whole grain.
Right.
How many grams in a serving?
Right. And they're saying around 10 to 15 grams of whole grains per serving is kind of what you're looking for. At least a minimum of 8, if possible, would be good, would be considered whole grain. Whole grain basically means they're using all of the grain, the germ, the bran, the endosperm, all that kind of stuff. And that's because that has more of the nutrients in it. I think a lot of people think that whole grain is related to it's got to be higher in fiber.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be, and in many ways, whole grain products are higher in fiber, but they're not necessarily hugely high in fiber just because they're whole grain. So, for example, a whole grain, it says it on the label, so it has to have the right amount in there of a tortilla chip, for example, versus a regular tortilla chip, probably has a gram of fiber per serving or even 2 grams of fiber per serving, whereas the others maybe have a half a gram or, you know, so there'd be a little bit more fiber in there and a little bit more nutrients because of the whole grain, which is great. I want people to consume whole grains, and if they choose the whole grain tortilla chip and they only eat the same serving that they were going to and it's a low enough serving, then fine. I think that's a great way to go. And I think there are some really good things that we've done with food, not only the labeling, but the actual product that's really helpful for people to get in to consume a better diet. I think the other issue, to me anyways, with whole grains is you do want to make half of your grain servings whole. And if you go to the My Pyramid, mypyramid.gov, that website, it talks about getting a minimum of 6 ounces of in that whole grain category or in the grain category each day minimum for the lowest amount of calorie diet. And about half of that needs to be whole. So you could have some white rice as part of your whole grain part of it. But then you also want to make sure that you're having a good grain, whole grain bread, you know, maybe for your sandwich, and making sure you're getting some other whole grains, maybe in a whole grain cereal as well. So you can have a little bit of the non-whole grain ones, and that's fine. But you want to do at least half of the servings that you consume in a day to be whole. And that will get you a little more fiber, get you a little more nutrients. And generally, the whole grain products are a little healthier. There are whole grain, like Chips Ahoy cookies,
right,
and, you know, and those sorts of things. I don't know. My biggest concern, and has been a concern of mine being a dietitian for a long time, particularly with young people, is, you know, that perception, if whole grain is better, if trans fat free is better, then I can just consume as much of it as I want. And that doesn't mean that at all.
Right. Right. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and it is the first Monday of the month of the day of the month that we take up the topic of nutrition. My name is Celeste Quinn, our guest this afternoon, registered dietitian Lisa Burgoon. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's go back to the phones now. We've got a listener waiting for us on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
They have come out with vitamin C enriched with bioflavonoids. And I would like to know what bioflavonoids are. It says they're antioxidants. And that's about it. I was wondering what sort of compound it is, what it's related to, and where it's found in nature, I suppose. The bio means that it's a natural product.
Right. Flavonoids is one of the compounds that we typically call phytochemicals. And so they come in phyto meaning plant. And the chemical is just a natural chemical that's found in that plant. And so there's a, I don't know, I think there's over 600 that have been identified in nature that some research has been done on in terms of the different types of phytochemicals. And the flavonoids, which is this, I assume, is this vitamin C enriched with a bioflavonoid. And you're absolutely right. The bio means that they didn't necessarily extract it from a plant. They made it. And we make vitamins, and that's okay. But the flavonoids are found in a variety of different foods, many fruits and vegetables. Anything that's plant-based is probably going to have a flavanol, but there's more in fruits and vegetables. There's some flavonoids also in your grain products. And so, and you said this was vitamin C enriched. This was an actual, like a dietary supplement, not a food that was enriched with.
No, it's in vitamin C tablets.
Okay, it's a tablet. Okay. And so what they did, vitamin C is also an antioxidant. So it's an antioxidant vitamin. And they enriched it with a bioflavonol or flavonoid that just has more antioxidant properties in it. That's his
well, what do these antioxidants do again?
Antioxidants in the body, they're things that sort of break down the byproducts of all the different metabolism in our system. So when we breathe in oxygen and we take in nutrients and we have to digest those things and we have to absorb them and it takes oxygen and we blow off carbon dioxide, you know, to get rid of that gas. What happens with antioxidants is you want the antioxidants to kind of come into your cells and take care of any other byproducts that might be breakdown products in your cells. So antioxidants are a good thing. They've been touted also to, decrease maybe in certain areas. I'm not going to say that they're cancer preventers exactly, but when carcinogen is found in the body, sometimes those antioxidants can keep it from replicating per se. So that means that it might, there are plenty of the different types of antioxidants that have been shown to at least hopefully prevent some types of cancers. So, you know,
that has something to do with free radicals.
Yeah, absolutely. You got that one right. That's very good. So those free radicals go around and you want to make sure that you attach them to something else that's not, you don't necessarily want those running around there too much. Those antioxidants are helping take care of those.
Okay. Are there some fruits or vegetables that are particularly rich in these bioflavonoids?
Well, a lot of your colorful, so go with color. It's kind of like what we say with beta carotene is mostly oranges. Go with the color so you can get a variety of the different flavanols because it's not just one. There's different ones that are in the different fruits and vegetables. So get a colorful diet in there.
Now, chemically, can you tell me what sort of compound it is? What does it look like? Like structurally or something?
Boy.
Does it have benzene rings?
That's a question for a chemist.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I know that. We've probably got it in some of our nutrition books, but I...
But it's not related to anything else that people are more familiar with.
I don't know enough to be able to say that, I don't think. My chemistry's a long time ago.
Apparently it's difficult because my wife asked the pharmacist what these bioflavonoids were. And he didn't know.
Okay.
And then he scurried around and got some books, and he couldn't find the answer. So I'm a little bit puzzled. They seem to be very mysterious things, and nobody seems to know exactly what they are or what they do for sure. Is it the same kind of thing that supposedly is in red wine?
In red wine, it's... resveratrol, which is what's in red wine, and that's found primarily in the skin of grapes that they use to make the red wine. Similar in a way because it is one of those phytochemicals. It is an antioxidant or it has antioxidant properties. So it is similar. Again, there's like 600 or more different phytochemicals out there. So it's not surprising that we haven't done a whole lot of research on all of these things. I'm sure that somewhere a biochemist has the breakdown of what actually, the carbons and the hydrogens and all that in your flavanols.
Okay.
I don't personally.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. I'm actually looking for some more information about what we were talking about previously, the fats and oils. I'm just wondering if I could get some information about Olestra and Olene and just see what we think about that. And I'll hang up and listen. So thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Wow. That was a real hot topic probably 10 years ago, and it's sort of fallen off of the radar, it seems like, although it's still around. The Olene brand of it, the Olene is the actual oil part of what olestra is. So olestra is inolein, and it's used primarily as a fat source in chips. Is pretty much various chips, I think, in a few crackers and a few other places, but mostly it's in the potato chip industry for the most part. Still around, if you've seen the, I'm thinking it's Lay's Light chips, I believe, they have some olestra in them. And generally, they become 0 grams of fat, so your body can't absorb it. So olestra basically is a product that has fat properties that can be used in food, in high-temperature cooking in particular, frying. And your body just, when it takes it in, when you consume it, it can't absorb it, okay? And that's when people started to have trouble with, well, if you can't absorb it, then that can't be good for you, maybe. Is it safe? It turns out that they've done tons of studies on it, and it's safe for the body. The FDA has approved it as a supplement to be used in food additives or a food additive. The problem is if you can't absorb it, sometimes what happens is it attaches onto some of the vitamins and minerals, the fat-soluble vitamins and minerals that you are also consuming maybe with those chips, and it kind of attaches to vitamins A, D, E, and K, are your fat-soluble vitamins, and you might end up removing some of those vitamins. And so what they did is they went back and remanufactured the olestra and olein and added fat-soluble vitamins back into that actual product. So they don't have to worry about the vitamin deficiency part of that. So that's basically what olestra is. It's still out there, still being used, probably an okay, product. The main caution is, again, like we've been talking about with people thinking, oh, if it's trans fat free, I can have a bunch of it. You do not want to eat a bunch of olestra cooked chips, because what happens is that what we call it is you end up with maybe an oily residue in your stool, and that's the oil coming out that you can't
wasn't absorbed.
Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it can be uncomfortable. And we'll leave it at that.
Okay, and let's go to another listener, a caller in St. Joe on line 3. Hi.
Hi. I make my own bread, and I have red wheat and white wheat, and I was wondering what the difference is nutritionally in them. I know I've received different information from different places about them, and I was wondering if you could tell me that. And just one other question, when I grind my wheat in a wheat grinder, and I know that it loses nutrients, and I was just wondering how quickly it loses nutrients after it's ground. Like how long after should I not be using it?
Well, with the grinder, you probably want to just grind as you go along. I think that's a good – I tell people to do that when they're grinding flax, when they're grinding anything, unless you have a defatted flour, which you probably – I'm assuming you probably don't.
No.
Just because you're going to lose quality much more so than I'm worried about losing of nutrients. But anytime air gets to something that, you just want to limit the amount of air and light, et cetera, that gets to it. So if you can grind as you go, that would be great. I know that's sometimes not as convenient.
Well, it's okay. I just, like the next morning, is that okay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you just don't, a lot of times what I find people do is they grind up a whole bunch of it, put it in a sack, and then don't use it for a month or two. And you really probably don't want to do that, especially with, any of you, it sounds like you're buying red wheat.
Yes, I have red and white.
And, those are things that are probably organic, that probably have not had any sorts of, stabilizers put in them or any additives that are designed to make it shelf stable,
mm-hmm.
Which is good. That's a good thing. So I would probably grind as I go. In terms of red versus white wheat, I really don't know the answer. Are you talking about in terms of like B vitamins, et cetera?
I'm assuming there's more fiber in the red wheat because it just seems to be heavier, and I don't know. I mean, it makes a lot heavier bread than the white wheat, but I don't know if there's any other difference besides the fiber.
Right. I'm not sure that fiber is what's making your bread heavier in that product. It could be, gluten its consistency with the gluten, too. So that I'm not sure about. You know, when I've looked at wheats and various other bread types of products that are wheat-based, I don't know that I've ever noticed much of a difference in the fiber content. And since you're grinding your own and you're getting good organic, what sounds like to be good organic grain, you're probably getting the most nutrients that you can. And I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of difference between red and white.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
What a great idea.
Yeah.
Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Central Indiana on line 4 on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I hope you can hear me all right. I'm shelling corn as we talk. Recently, last 13 months, I've lost about 75 pounds, basically just not eating any refined sugar. Lost about 70 cholesterol points, blood pressure's down. Two-part question, though. I've been using a lot of artificial sweetener. Sweet and Low is my, which I know is not that healthy. And also I've been using, eating about probably up to a half a cup of peanut butter a day with different fruits as a source of protein and just for taste. So wondering what's your thoughts on substitute sweeteners? And I've tried the natural peanut butter, but just can't get a taste for it. So I'm going to hang up and listen offline, if that'd be all right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, as far as the artificial sweeteners go, and this includes Sweet and Low, you know, the ones that are out there, pink, blue, and yellow, for the most part, there are other ones out there, of course. There have been so many studies on these things that from if you're concerned about the safety issue, you know, in terms of especially with Sweet and Low with, you know, it says right on the label, you know, can cause cancer in rats, etc., which it did in a study back in 1970, whatever it was. For the most part, though, if you have a reasonable intake of any of these types of products, and I guess what is reasonable, you know, probably not more than 10 to 20 packets a day would be fairly reasonable. I know a lot of dietitians don't like people using sugar substitutes, not necessarily from a safety standpoint, but from the standpoint of, you know, are you then relying on your sweet tooth and that sort of thing? But I think, you know, congratulations, by the way, for losing 70 pounds or 75 pounds, I think you said, and that mm-hmm. has helped your cholesterol go down and your blood pressure go down. And if you need to have some sort of sugar substitute to keep yourself on that diet and keep that weight off, then I think that's going to be absolutely fine. The problem that's happening now is you're also seeing particularly this Splenda brand of sweetener in a lot of products. And so you could have Splenda in yogurt that you're consuming and then packets in your coffee. And then, you know, and once that starts to add up, then I'm getting a little bit concerned. I'm still not concerned about the safety issue, but I'm more concerned about just what does it do to you from a diet standpoint and a flavor standpoint, and do you enjoy your foods, et cetera. As far as a half cup of peanut butter, that's a lot of peanut butter. Now, clearly, if you've been doing this during your weight loss program and your body can handle that many calories from the peanut butter, fine. And if you don't like the natural, now, you did mention that you did some of the dietary changes and didn't have any refined sugar. If you're using regular off-the-shelf peanut butter that's not natural, you're getting some refined sugar in there, which is okay so long as you're not using too much of the other, you know, the other refined sugars that you've managed to get out of your diet. If a half cup works for you, if you're out, you know, combining corn for the next couple of weeks and you're very active and you can handle the calories from the peanut butter, I think it's fine. It's a good source of protein. You've got great oils in there that are probably helping to get your cholesterol level down as well. I can't really argue with it, but I wouldn't say that that's something I would recommend to the majority of the population that's trying to lose weight just because of the calorie content.
Yeah. Also, you know, peanut butters are another thing to look at the label because there are great differences between
yes, there can be.
peanut butters in terms of how much sugar they do contain.
Right. Yeah, and you might find one that has a little bit less sugar in it but isn't a reduced sugar type and just maybe change the brand up. And if you're eating half a cup a day, you're changing brand. You could change brands pretty often without throwing anything away. So I think that would be all right.
That's right. I want to thank that gentleman for calling us this afternoon. And as Lisa said, congratulations. That's terrific. Let's talk with someone in McLean County now on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I have several questions for you. See if I can remember a couple of them at least. One of them is, I've been using Smart Balance.
Yes.
Yeah.
The margarine.
Yes, the margarine. And on the label, it says no trans fats, but it says, I'm reading it to you, natural oil blend. The first ingredient is palm fruit. And I'm just wondering what the difference between palm fruit and a palm and the coconut oil we've been told for years not to use. Would you know that?
And I know whenever you see palm, you're thinking, oh my gosh, they're telling me to use this for heart health, but we've always heard palm kernel oil. And coconut oils are things that we should avoid. And the palm fruit actually has some of those monounsaturates, similar to like avocados, which have we think, oh, they're so high in fat, but they have a lot of the monounsaturates. So Smart Balance is designed, it's the blend of the different oils that are in there that give it just the right blend of omega-3, omega-6, monounsaturates, and polyunsaturates. So the palm fruit is actually one that's, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm, okay. The other thing I was going to ask you about is not Danactive. What's the other product? They have the probiotics in it?
The Activia yogurt?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The Activia yogurt doesn't say probiotic on it, does it? But I think it's the Danactive. Actually, that is right. The Danactive is a little liquid drink.
Oh, okay.
It's made by Dan and also,
right.
It's little, it's 3.3 ounces, and it says, and they used to say over a billion, blah, 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 something.
Oh,
like
the
that.
Live bacteria.
Yeah. How does probiotic work in terms of that versus just eating yogurt? No?
The reason that we would always tell people to eat yogurt, to settle the intestinal tract, et cetera, was because of the probiotics, because of the bacteria that is actually in the yogurts.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but what happened is at some point yogurts, they started removing the live cultures and they would put non-live cultures into the yogurts. I'm not exactly sure why that happened for a while. But now, since we know that probiotics, those live bacteria, those good, healthy bacteria that are in our system and that we can consume and increase the amount of those good, active bacteria in our intestinal tract. Mm-hmm. So most yogurts, even if they don't say Danactive, I think.
Right, yeah.
Even if they don't say that, you can look on the label and it'll say maybe live cultures or live bacteria. That's what you're looking for, especially if you're looking for some sort of help with intestinal gas or, relieving diarrhea, those types of things.
This is slightly, it appears to be slightly different than Danactive in the sense that it's called a probiotic drink versus Danactive, which is basically the one where they advertise it's take it for 14 days or whatever else.
Right.
So I'm just curious why the difference, and if you by chance know, because one of them calls it probiotic, the other one really doesn't call it probiotic. It just says, to help for your GI tract,
Yeah, I think they might. It might just be a difference in how they choose to label things. I'm pretty sure that what they're talking about, similar to kefir, if you've heard of kefir, which is also considered a probiotic, it's how they are telling you what it is. I would say
how they're branding themselves.
They have two different products,
Oh, I know.
They have the yogurt, and then they have this, and then it says. And I was trying to find because I'd saved a label. Just off of that. I can't find it right now. But
okay.
Anyway, one says probiotic and the other one doesn't say probiotic. And supposedly with IBS, probiotic is supposed to help.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And what helps is once it gets into the gut, what those bacteria do is they produce really healthy...
Your flora and your fauna.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm like, okay, your flora, that's right. I was trying to come up with a different word, and I couldn't come up with it. But when they do that, then those bacteria give off really good things that help the intestinal tract, right on the lumen of the intestinal tract, you know, either heal or do a better job of what they need to be doing. So it may be that they're saying probiotic with one because it maybe has more live cultures and it meets, there may even be some sort of a standard to say it's an actual probiotic. They may have to have over 2 million bacteria. I'm just pulling those numbers out, but that may be the difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, if someone else is not waiting on the line, another line, could I ask you one more question? If there is, I don't mind hanging up. I can always call you back the next time you're on.
That's right.
But,
I think I'll ask you to do that because I've got three other
sure,
listeners.
Sure. Yeah, I'll call back another time. But thank you very much.
Okay, good questions. Thanks for the call.
Welcome.
Next we go to a listener in Bloomington on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
I have a question about sugar. If you're wanting to or cut down on refined sugar, do you gain anything by going to standard brown sugar that you buy in the grocery?
That's a good question. And you would think, you know, just like with white bread versus brown bread, that brown sugar would be better. But nope, it's still a refined sugar. Yeah. Same thing.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm not happy with that.
I know. You could try Splenda brown if you want a little less sugar.
Oh, well, no thanks. I'll avoid that. Thank
you.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hi. I'm doing a low-carb, high-protein diet, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about ketosis and what I should watch out for.
Sure. Ketosis, actually, if you're doing super low carb and higher protein, what happens is your body changes over from using carbohydrate to be used for energy to be using more of protein and fat. Primarily, what that leads to is your body builds up ketone bodies, and the ketone bodies can be used for energy and can be used for energy in the brain as well as, you know, for other sources. In terms of what to look for, you don't end up in ketosis that's problematic unless you're super, super low carbohydrate and super high protein and fat. Acetone breath, a fruity odor on your breath, is one pretty typical thing that you might notice. And the other thing is oftentimes you'll start urinating quite a bit and be frequently thirsty. And that would be, you know, a pretty good symptom that you're probably overdoing.
And what would be the medical problem with, having bad breath and going to the bathroom a lot?
Right. Aside from that, if you can handle that. the basic thing is this. Your brain, in order to function properly, the brain can use ketone bodies, but the rest of your body really can't do it all that well. And generally, you need about 120 grams of carbohydrate per day to keep that brain functioning the best that it can. Now, it can transition over, and you can transition over some of the other foods that you're consuming, the protein and the fat, and turn them into glucose. So for the most part, so long as you're not in actual ketosis, which could cause ketoacidosis, which is, you know, can be life-threatening.
Right.
Most people just don't follow the diet so closely that that's going to ever happen to them. But, you know, you can go into ketosis and that throws the pH of your blood off. And when that happens, then it's not a good thing. But I just don't see that much in these types of diets.
Okay.
You have to be really strict to do that.
That helps a lot. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Next, we talk with a listener in Charleston on line three. It'll have to be quick. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to know what the difference is between wheat germ and wheat bran and whether one is more nutritional than the other.
Wheat germ's got more B12 and B6 than wheat bran. I guess it depends on why you what you want to use it for.
Well, I use it in cooking bread and the like.
Oh, okay. You know what? I think putting wheat germ in breads is a great idea just to boost up the vitamin B content. Your wheat bran is going to give you more of your fiber.
Than wheat germ.
More fiber than wheat germ. Yes.
All right. Thanks.
You're welcome. And there we've done it.
Wow.
We've taken care of all the callers, and we're right on time.
Great.
Lisa, thank you very much for
joining us
this afternoon. Lisa Burgoon is a registered dietitian. She teaches in the Food Sciences and Human Nutrition Department in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. And this topic, diet nutrition, we take it up once a month on the first Monday of the month.